Holy crowd, but I'd like to welcome you here this evening. I'm Barbara Elliott. Can't hear me, all right? What do I need to do? You think you got it? Is this better? Absolutely not. All right. No wonder you couldn't hear me. All right. Now that I'm properly mic'd, may I introduce myself to you, Barbara Elliott. I'd like to welcome you this evening. This is an evening of heroes. You have all come because you knew about one that you wanted to hear the story from. We have, however, two others. The unsung heroes. I'm only going to leave you with that tantalizing bit of information before we progress with our program. They've all been fighting for freedom, but on different fronts. Leaving you with that little appetizer, I'd like to ask John Wilson to come here and give us the invocation.
Let us pray. This is from Psalm 127, and let us ponder the reasons behind which, but behind the conversations we've had this wonderful weekend. Except the Lord build the house, their labor is but loss that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. Now let us bless, O Father, thy gifts to our use and us to thy service. Give us grateful hearts for all thy mercies, and make us mindful of the needs of others. Amen.
All of us have had a terrific program to listen to this past day and last evening. I'd like to take this opportunity to congratulate all of the speakers, the panelists. The presentations were just outstanding, truly. I know I, for one, have learned a great deal about a region of the world that I have not given as much attention to as I might have. I have a legitimate excuse, though. I've spent the last, up until 2 years ago, had been living in Europe for 14 years. And one tends to focus on the new countries to be understood then and learned about. If I had known I was going to end up living in Houston, I think I would have devoted more energy to learning Spanish rather than German, which I did, survival French, menu Italian, greetings in Russian. I have a whole new language ahead of me. Freddie's nodding. It has been a challenge for me to come back to a country that is different than the one that I left now 14 years ago. I have, however, had the wonderful opportunity to discover heroes. I spent 14 years in Europe, and the last six of them basically documenting what was taking place that led up to the fall of the Berlin Wall. And there were genuine heroes, people who resisted because of their faith and because of their moral convictions. I had an opportunity to help some of them put down roots in reaching out to the efforts around them as they were rebuilding the countries that had been freed from communism. In the past 2 years since I've been back in the United States, I have been crisscrossing the country essentially in search of heroes here. Heroes of different sort, however. I'll give you an idea of the sort of itinerary, and it'll give you an idea of what kind of different clientele. It's taken me to some unlikely places like a skid house, flop house in Denver for homeless alcoholic men. It has taken me to immigrants in a poor neighborhood of Brooklyn. It's taken me to a shelter for homeless welfare mothers in Dallas. It has also taken me to recovering crack and heroin addicts right here in San Antonio. I've been in search of people who are willing to stand with courage, to take a difficult situation and to say not just someone should do something about it, but I should do something about it. I've been looking for people who are willing to reach out to the poor and to those who are addicted and to those who are homeless and reach out to them not with a mentality of I'm from the government, I need to help you, but with a mentality of I care about you and I'm willing to extend my hand personally to help you lead a transformed life, if you're willing. Some of the people who have been living that, I think, are truly the greatest unsung heroes of our country. As it turns out, two of my very favorites in the entire country are from San Antonio. and are seated right here at our head table, Freddie Garcia, Jimmy Heirich from Victory Fellowship and also from Teen Challenge, are two of the heroes you didn't know you were going to meet this evening. Adolfo Calero will be speaking to you later, but I couldn't let this opportunity pass to recognize two unsung heroes. It turns out that the issue of drugs is something that came up in every single panel today, and it struck me how interesting it was that nobody had planned that on the agenda. These two men have devoted their lives to helping people leave drug addiction. They also do so with personal knowledge of what it's like to be addicted. Both of them were. You know, I found that the conservative movement has been very good at resisting and describing the things that the government ought not to do. We've been less good, I think, at identifying that which is good in the private sector, that which really works, and then holding it up to the light to say, this is beautiful. We ought to do this ourselves. I'd like to just take a moment, if I may, to tell you two stories. One of them, which will center on Jimmy Heirich here, who is from Teen Challenge, started actually in 1958. A man named David Wilkerson went to New York to work with gang members. Now, what he discovered was that the problems with gangs were more complex than just the gang wars. He had to deal with things like prostitution and homosexuality and hardcore drug addiction. From that experience grew his outreach, which he then called Teen Challenge. It was basically to give kids a vision of a better kind of life. Since that time, 130 chapters have sprung up in this country, 150 more of them abroad. Teen Challenge has been meeting alcohol and drug addiction head-on, essentially challenging people to change. Instead of having licensed counselors who come in and commiserate or talk about necessary for therapy, they say straight on, as somebody who's been an addict themselves, you have to change your life. We'll help you, but you have to change. Now, Teen Challenge had an incredible success rate. They were claiming 70% success rate. Well, the Department of HEW took exception to that figure. They said this can't be possible. Their programs, government-run programs and other secular programs, were averaging about 6 to 10%. This is not a good comparison. Being somewhat less than enthused by this lackluster competition, which they were losing, they simply said, all right, we're going to do a study on this and see how effective you really are. Well, lo and behold, they did this study, and the result was not 70% success rate in turning around lives, but actually 86%. This was embarrassing. The Teen Challenge people had a follow-up study done on them, basically looking to see where they were 7 years after they left the program, most of them drug-free. Follow-up study came about 2 years ago, and they essentially tracked people who had left Teen Challenge 13 years ago. 67 of them were still drug-free and had not gone back into other programs. Something's working. Something's working. How do they do it? Well, the key seems to be that they are challenging people to change from the inside out. And they're dealing with addiction not just as a chemical problem, but essentially as a decision, a moral decision. They also believe that unless an addict has had a personal encounter with Jesus Christ, that he cannot be transformed. Now, this is a message that some people might find pretty strong medicine. Some of you may not be comfortable with it. I'll simply say, look at the results. Since that time, Teen Challenge has operated without government funding purely throughout the entire country. 2 years ago, however, there was a showdown at the Alamo, just a few blocks from here. The Texas Commission of the Drug, Alcohol, what is it called? TCADA. Texas Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse. I got it. I only speak acronym. Claimed that despite this incredible track record, that basically Teen Challenge had to shut down. They did not qualify as a, quote, substance abuse treatment program because, well, they said, you know, basically in effect, the heck with your results. Here are these problems. You don't have the required 9 sets of records in each personnel file, which is a violation of standard 116A. You don't have the 6-step client grievance procedure, which is a violation of 144B. Your carpet needs repair, which is in violation of 353H, which clearly states stairs are supposed to have uniform non-slip surfaces. Your counselors don't have the necessary degrees, and besides that, your blankets are blocking the fire exit door. So Jimmy Heirich, who is seated here, was under orders to close down Teen Challenge or face fines of $4,000 a day plus jail time. Now, this prompted 325 people to rally at the Alamo. It was July 17th, 1995, a sweltering midday sun beating down on the people who were protesting basically this idiocy. They delivered a blistering protest and sang such well-known protest songs as When the Saints Go Marching In. Placards appeared in the crowd, which was largely black and Hispanic. It said things like, Because of Jesus, I'm no longer a debt to the state of Texas. And it also said things like, Once a burden, now a taxpayer. Now, Jimmy Hyrick says, We don't take government grants, so we don't have a lot of money. That's a direct quote. His program only costs $25 a day, and it is supported purely by donations. Now, he can fix the problem with his kitchen, but he can't afford to hire chemical dependency counselors with the proper necessary PhDs required by the government. He doesn't want their help. He simply wants to be left alone to do what he does well and to help them turn around their lives. Well, this rally at the Alamo had a happy conclusion, partially because other people rallied to their defense. Marvin Olasky wrote an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, which got a lot of people's attention. He took the case to his publication, World Magazine, and simply by drawing attention to what was about to happen here, the authorities backed off. Now, as it turned out, Governor Bush has since, because of the confrontation with these two groups here, arm wrestled with his legislature to basically exempt faith-based chemical dependency treatment programs from the state licensing procedure. It's a small step, but it's a major one. As it turned out, this showdown at the Alamo was successful. He won. I would like to take this opportunity to invite Jimmy and his wife, Sally, to come up here. I have a small additional PS story to tell you. I'm a newlywed. My husband Winston is here. We have been married for 2 months, and we decided that we would like to give a gift as our wedding present to them. So in our name, we would like you to also join me in congratulating them for their work. Wynn is a drug rehabilitation center, not a drug rehabilitation center. When the Texas state officials say it's not, that's when. Never mind that 13,000 drug addicts have turned their lives around with the help of Victory Fellowship. If it's not a state licensed center, complying with all the regulations, they doggone better well call themselves something else. So as not to incur the wrath of the officials, the addicts, that former addicts that Freddie Garcia sends out in the San Antonio neighbors here, distributed little handbills saying, Victory Fellowship is not a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. It is a church that rehabilitates drug addicts and alcoholics through the preaching of the gospel. The man behind this, the rescue of these 13,000 addicts, looked like an unlikely candidate for heroism 30 years ago. Then a heroin addict, he had a moment of truth one day as he was in a men's room at a gas station looking for a vein to shoot up, his infant daughter swaddled in toilet paper on the floor, and he looked for a moment at his life and said there must be a better way. He had been on the streets for a number of years, had stolen to support his habit, losing his last shred of dignity. He had tried to quit and had fallen on his face. With the help of a faith-based program, Freddie this time actually kicked heroin. Nobody was more surprised than he was, actually. Well, that's not quite true. Actually, his then common law wife, Ninfa, who was already the mother of his children, he asked her to marry him. She did. She's here. The two of them have been together since, reaching out in what has blossomed into a multi-ministry to drug addicts, prostitutes, prison inmates, gang members, and others not high on the list of clientele that pastors would usually seek for their church. An effective 3-year training program takes people who have come through the program who want to go in and counsel others and teaches them how to do it. You can call it a church, you can call it a home for the unloved and unwashed, call it whatever you want. It empowers people to change. Freddie's approach stands a conventional wisdom on its ear. He claims drug addiction is a symptom. As he puts it, sin is the problem. Jesus Christ is the solution. Scoffers may not like his methodology, but it's very tough to argue with the results. 60 to 70% of the addicts who walk in off the streets to his centers right here in San Antonio find something that enables them to leave drug addiction. Good number of them come back to become pastors and counselors in his work. They've discovered that there's nobody more effective in reaching an addict than somebody who's been an addict. When I last visited them a few months ago, they were recovered addicts who gave a high wattage show in a very posh office building to a somewhat stunned business audience. Four former criminals who had been heroin addicts told their story of crime, drugs, jail, and a radically different drug-free life since. These men now go back to the jails where they were and to the men who shared needles and burglaries with them. And they leave the inmates with one message. These inmates look at them and say, if this guy can change, I can too. Across town at Victory Home, where I also visited, two heroin addicts had just wandered in off the streets, just coming down. They wanted help. They each received a mentor, somebody who would walk with them over the next hours and days, somebody who would wipe their forehead when they began to sweat in withdrawal, to hold the bowl when they vomited, to walk with them at night when they couldn't sleep, and to just love them. They know what they're going through because they've done it themselves. The principle that they practice there is very straightforward. Their work is based on love, authority, supervision, and discipline. Addiction is treated with spiritual transformation. Freddy Garcia loves to say things. He's quite provocative. He says, if you treat an addict with a drug rehab program, all you have is a reformed junkie. If he meets Christ, he's transformed. He's a new person. Victory Fellowship has neither sought or received any government funding. When Ron Rivera addressed a group of Washington legislators, it was a conference for new legislators this past December in Washington with the Heritage Foundation, he simply told them, we don't want your money. Just let us do what we do. That sounds simple enough, but neither HUD nor the Texas Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse saw it that way. HUD demanded 40 pieces of documentation, including a, quote, description of the target population, unquote, and an explanation of the appropriateness of services and activities for the target population in terms of age, socioeconomic level, language, and ethnicity slash cultural background, end of the final quote. And they wanted a detailed budget and expenditures, funding sources. They also demanded that Victory Fellowship pay $5,000 a year in rent and to buy an expensive insurance policy, and all of this to cover a service which is free. Now, Freddy Garcia would also have had to hire a certain requisite number of PhDs. He counters, my people have an education out on the streets you can't get at Yale University. Partially because Freddy continued to resist, Texas legislation now exempts his work from this licensing requirement. He runs a tight ship. His program costs about $30 a day. And the people who are tackling the drug and gang issues are people who live in the same zip code as those that they're reaching out to. They also tell addicts that they see out on the street, either you can clean up your act now or we'll visit you in jail. They do. Gang intervention teams are now in housing projects here, and they're basically a safe zone. Both gangs, or however many competing gangs there are, have acknowledged that these houses, if someone goes to that door, leave them alone. And essentially, the young people who have chosen to leave a gang, well then, it's the only exception, are not killed. As long as they remain a part of this group, this ministry, and stay with their faith, they're safe. It's a real incentive to stay there, as we've discovered. The model has spread to 65 centers in 5 countries because it's effective. Right now, Freddy is doing a similar kind of work through other people in Venezuela, in Colombia, in Puerto Rico. I know it's not another country. In Peru, in Mexico. He wants to soon in Cuba and in Nicaragua. Anyone who can open doors in either of those countries, please talk to Freddy. He has plans. The effective thing is that it's people reaching out who've been there themselves, Freddie likes to say this, "The only requirement you have to get in my program is to be some kind of criminal. God has raised up an army of rejects." May I invite Freddie and Ninfa Garcia to come up, please.
Ninfa started me on drugs.
It's really bad. And she's been paying for it ever since. They're all going to be joining us later in the evening, and for those of you who'd like to talk to them individually, they have incredible stories. So after we have heard of the other adventures of heroism that we're about to now, please do join us for the celebrations later. I'm going to call on our illustrious president, M. Stanton Evans, the snappy dresser, sharp dancer, and I think I'll stop there. Enough things. Anyway... and famous jokester who will introduce our speaker of the evening.
Thank you, Barb. That was inspiring. I think everyone would concur in that. Just a couple of brief comments. I want to apologize to some of our visitors from south of the border for a joke I told last night, which used a term which probably was not immediately comprehensible if you are not familiar with our commercial products in the United States. The joke about the club and probably had to be explained if you don't have that in your countries. This is a mechanism that we fasten around the steering wheel of our automobiles to keep congressmen from stealing them. That was the point of that joke. Now, I make that explanation because I have another joke kind of like it, which is even a little bit off color, but it's a really good joke. So I got to tell it. You may have heard it, and it's it begins with it's a riddle, and it's a question. Why do the Kennedy men always cry when they make love? And the answer is, it's the mace. So that's another product that we have here. Just thought I'd explain that. It's a couple of things. So many great presentations. One of the things that Bill Campbell did in his very fine presentation at the luncheon was to stress the 200th anniversary of the death of Edmund Burke. And as he pointed out, the direct connection, I love the way he put it, the direct connections with Latin America were slender. That was very well said. Reminded me, and he talked about Burke sort of giving a review of William Robertson's history, and that's the way he kind of worked it out to talk about Latin American. Burke referred to this as a solid book. Is that, am I correctly quoting that, Bill? And he reminded me there was an almost exactly contemporaneous book published at that time, another famous historian in the United Kingdom. And that was Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which was published in 1776, if I remember correctly. And there was a great story, and I can't remember the name of it. All those authors tried to develop patrons. Burke himself did, and the letter to a noble lord, and many other things were really kind of in that framework. And Gibbon, trying to develop, I guess, some backing support, presented this masterpiece, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which is many thousands of pages long, to some English lord from whom Gibbon hoped to get some support. And what the English lord said as he took this from Gibbon and looked at it, and this is, I think, a verbatim quote, "Another damn fat book." "Scribble, scribble, scribble, eh, Mr. Gibbon?" And I thought, this is what happens to scribblers. They are not treated perhaps always with respect they deserve. And so Burke was a little more discerning. And one other thing that you said, Bill, I wanted to pick up in this tribute to Burke, and I'll get off this. The great quote that Burke was a member of the Church of England, but because of his mother was a Catholic, therefore, nevertheless, and it reminded me of a story I've told, that my grandmother, maternal grandmother, who's not from Texas but from Mississippi, her description of a person of whom she did not approve, somewhat similar, she described him as an Episcopalian with leanings toward Christianity. And, okay, well, that's enough about Burke. We've done Burke. I think Peter Stanlis would be proud of us. Now, let's move to our featured speaker of the evening. And I'll begin with a segue from Washington. I was talking to somebody who was not familiar with life in the District of Columbia under Mayor Barry and our government there. And they said, my office is right on Capitol Hill, and I have an apartment there, and I'm basically a resident of the district. And the person said, what is it like to live in Washington, D.C.? It must be pretty bad. I said, well, I would describe it as like living under communism, but without any of the benefits. That in theory, under communism, it's a police state, but they're supposed to give you stuff. And as far as they never give me any stuff. They just have a police state. So now, I'm well aware that in reality, the communists don't give you any stuff either. And our speaker this evening knows that far better than I. I spent a fair amount of time back in the 80s, as did many of us, covering, writing about, reporting the struggle in Nicaragua and Central America generally, and indeed throughout the Caribbean, between the forces of liberty and the forces of Marxist aggression. And if you judged that situation by what was in the Washington Post, you would have a very incorrect, to put it mildly, a picture of what was going on there. And the more I looked into it, the more it confirmed what I like to call Evans' Law of inadequate paranoia, which basically says no matter how bad you think something is, when you look into it, it's always worse. And that was certainly the case with the Sandinistas, who were portrayed up in Washington as some kind of liberators of Nicaragua. The gentleman I'm about to introduce, I requested the honor of introducing him. I have been, as you all know, a bit overexposed at some of these meetings, talking all the time. But I really wanted to do this. I thought I've said enough things at this meeting, but I wanted to introduce him because it is a great honor to introduce him. It is the third time that I have introduced him to an audience in the United States. And each time, as I listen to him and talk to him, my respect for him grows, and it was substantial to begin with. He is someone that, like Musso, whom I introduced last evening, brings multiple attributes to this podium. One of his very fine attributes, I talked last night about being a native Texan. I'm very proud of that. But I also spent a long time in the state of Indiana. And this gentleman, I'm pleased to say, is an honorary Hoosier. He is a graduate of the University of Notre Dame, class of 1953. And he has attended other educational institutions in the United States as well. So that's one point. Another point is that he is has been, for all of his adult life, a working businessman and understands the economic realities of life in his country and indeed throughout the region and the hemisphere. Worked for Grace and Company and Coca-Cola and has many other activities in the realm of business enterprise. He has been very deeply involved in civic activities and in the politics of his country. But the principal distinction which brought him to the forefront of the news in the 80s and brings him here this evening and quite often to audiences in the United States is that he was the foremost leader of the resistance to the communization of his country by the Sandinistas. And that's what it was. And he sacrificed much. And to this day, I did not know this until we talked this evening, his house, the house that he owned, is still in the possession of the Sandinista, a Sandinista, I guess, down there. I don't know if you wanted me to mention that, but just an example of what went on down there. He became the spokesperson and the leader of the so-called Contras, the coalition of the anti-Marxist groups down there, came to Washington many times. That's when I first met him back in the mid-80s. And because of his courage and his integrity and his willingness to sacrifice for his country and for freedom, they won. They did something that had not really occurred previously in the history of the entire so-called Cold War. And we were discussing this a bit this evening, too. With the exception of Grenada, which was totally unique in that it was very small and was done by a surgical strike by our forces. Nicaragua is the only example, I think, in which a communist government had taken control of a country and was turned out, was resisted and rejected by the indigenous resistance that people were able to mobilize within that country or on its borders, albeit with some aid, far too little in my opinion, from the United States. It seems to me that that is an important fact, not only intrinsically for the people of Nicaragua and indeed the rest of Central America, because Nicaragua was the base for the subversion of Salvador, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you put it in a larger framework, it is even more significant, because that was the fulcrum of the so-called Reagan Doctrine, which turned the course of world history, because that was the the signal that it could be possible to roll back communism. And there were other examples of this, Afghanistan, Angola, where this doctrine was operative. So this is something of world historical importance, not just, although saying just is not a very good way to put it, not just what happened to one country, it's what happened to the world. So, having said those things, it is my belief that when the history of this century is accurately written, our speaker this evening will be grouped together with such people as His Holiness and President Reagan and Mrs. Thatcher, the leaders of the West who brought the evil empire down. Please welcome Adolfo Calero. Thank you.